84.1% of the time. The African members voted against the U.S. position 83.8% of the time. The non-aligned movement members voted against the U.S. position 82.7% of the time. And European Union members voted against the U.S. position 54.5% of the time. Yay! Go Europe! America's steadfast 45% friends. You can take the view of the European elites that this is proof of America's isolation and that the United States now needs to issue a declaration of interdependence with the world. Or you can be like the proud mom in Irving Berlin's Great War marching song. They were all out of step but Jim. But what the figures really demonstrate is that the logic of the post-Cold War UN is to be institutionally anti-American. Washington could seize on the embarrassments of the Kofi Annan regime and lean hard on Turtle Bay to reform this and reorganize that and reinvent the other, and, if they threw their full diplomatic muscle behind it, they might get those anti-U.S. votes down to, what, a tad over 80%? And along the way, they'd find that they'd reformed a corrupt, dysfunctional, sclerotic, anti-American club into a lean, mean, effectively functioning anti-American club, which is, if they're honest, what most reformers mean by reform. Economic power. The Sufi theologian and jurist Al-Ghazali, regarded by many as the greatest Muslim after Muhammad, died a millennium ago, but his words on the conduct of dhimmis, non-Muslims in Muslim society, seem pertinent today. The dhimmi is obliged not to mention Allah or his apostle. Jews, Christians, and Magians must pay the jizya. The jizya is the poll tax paid by non-Muslims to their Muslim betters. One cause of the lack of economic innovation in the Islamic world is that they've always placed the main funding burden of society on infidels. This goes back to Muhammad's day. If you take a bunch of warring Arab tribes and unite them as one ummah under Allah, one drawback is that you close off a prime source of revenue, fighting each other and then stealing each other's stuff. That's why the Prophet, while hardly in a position to deny Islam to those who wish to sign up, was relatively relaxed about the presence of non-Muslim peoples within Muslim lands. They were a revenue stream. If one looks at their comparative dissemination patterns, Christianity spread by acquiring believers and then land. Islam spread by acquiring land and then believers. When Islam conquered infidel territory, it set in motion a massive transfer of wealth, enacting punitive taxation to transfer money from non-believers to Muslims, or from the productive part of the economy to the non-productive. It was, in its way, a prototype welfare society. When admirers talk up Islam and the great innovations and rich culture of its heyday, they forget that even at its height, Muslims were never more than a minority in the Muslim world, and they were in large part living off the energy of others. That's still a useful rule of thumb. If you take the least worst Muslim societies, the reason for their dynamism often lies with whichever group they share the turf with, the Chinese in Malaysia, for example. But eventually, almost all Muslim societies tend toward the economically moribund, if only because an ever-shrinking infidel base eventually wises up. You can see it literally in the rural parts of the Balkans. Christian tradesmen got fed up paying the jizya and moved out of the towns up into remote hills. In other parts of the world, non-Muslims found it easier to convert. That's in part what drove Islamic expansion. Once Araby was all Muslim, it was necessary to move on to the Levant and to Persia and to Central Asia and North Africa and India and Europe in search of new infidels from which to extract the jizya. As engines of growth, the Muslim world and the European Union suffer a similar flaw. Both encourage defections to the non-productive segment of the economy. But the Muslim world has effortlessly extended the concept of jizya worldwide. If you're on the receiving end, it's possible to see the American, European, and Israeli subsidies of the Palestinian Authority as a form of jizya, or even the billions of dollars Washington has lavished on Egypt to such little effect, other than Mohammed Atta coming through the window. Not to mention every 20 bucks you put in the gas tank. The telegram has been replaced by the email, and the Victrola has yielded to the CD player, but aside from losing the rumble seat and adding a few cup holders, the automobile is essentially unchanged from a century ago. If you can't sell the country on the need for new energy sources when your present ones are funding your enemies, when can you? Yet, 5 years on from September 11th, and after a torrent of information on Saudi funding of the jihad, America had changed its policy to Riyadh only to this degree. We're lavishing even more dough on them than we did before. The oil revenue collected by the House of Saud not only buys off their subjects, but buys up other countries' subjects around the world. Americans are paying for the rope that will hang them. Information power. The fifth element of national power, information, speaks for itself, incessantly. The New York Times, CNN, Hollywood, the universities, Michael Moore. That is, quagmire, Islamophobia, Bush lied, exit strategy. In World War II, the sands of Iwo Jima were the main event, and rounding up enemy sympathizers in Michigan was the sideshow. One can argue that this time around, the priorities are reversed. That bombing Baby Assad out of the presidential palace in Damascus is a more marginal battlefield than turning back the tide of Islamist support in Europe and elsewhere. America and a select few other countries have demonstrated they can just about summon the war will on the battlefield. On the cultural front, where this war in the end will be won, there's little evidence of any kind of will. If you look at the United Kingdom and the impunity with which imams like Abu Hamza incite treason, it requires a perverse genius on the part of Tony Blair to have found the political courage to fight an unpopular war on a distant shore, but not the political courage to wage it closer to home, where it would have commanded far more support. That's the sad lesson of July 7th. Her Majesty's forces can police southern Iraq more effectively than southern England. If this were World War I, with their fellows in one trench and us in ours facing them over some boggy piece of terrain, it would be over very quickly, which the smarter Islamists have figured out. They know they can never win on the battlefield, but they figure there's an excellent chance they can drag things out until Western civilization collapses in on itself, and Islam inherits by default. An army is only one weapon a civilization wields, and the weapon of last resort, too. But when you add up those elements of national power, military, judicial, diplomatic, economic, informational, it's hard not to conclude that, as was said of the British after the fall of Singapore, at least four of those five guns are pointing in the wrong direction. The point of the media is to speak truth to domestic power. The point of transnationalism is to constrain American power. The point of law is to upgrade the defendant. And the upshot of economic power in a time of plenty is that every time you gas up, you're funding an enemy who's flusher than he's been since the fall of Constantinople. Meanwhile, we fight the symptoms, the terror plots, but not the cause, the ideology. The self-imposed constraints of this war, legalistic, multilateral, politically correct, are clearer every day. Know your enemy, they say. They know us very well. Do we know them at all? The faint-hearted hyperpower. In 2003, Tony Blair spoke to the United States Congress. As Britain knows, he said, All predominant power seems for a time invincible, but in fact it is transient. The question is, what do you leave behind? An excellent question. Today, 3/7 of the G7 major economies are nations of British descent. Of the 20 economies with the highest GDP per capita, no fewer than 11 are current or former realms of Her Britannic Majesty. And if you protest that most of those are pinprick colonial tax havens, Bermuda, the Caymans, okay, eliminate all territories with population lower than 20 million, and the top four is an Anglosphere sweep, the United States, United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia. The key regional players in almost every corner of the globe are British-derived, South Africa, India. And even among the lesser players, as a general rule, you're better off for having been exposed to British rule than not. Try doing business in Indonesia rather than Malaysia, or Haiti rather than St. Lucia. And of course, the preeminent power of the age derives its political character from 18th-century British subjects who took English ideas a little further than the mother country was willing to go. As for the allegedly inevitable superpower of the coming century, if China ever does achieve that status, it will be because the People's Republic learned more from British Hong Kong than Hong Kong ever did from the Little Red Book. Sir John Cooperthwaite, the colony's transformative financial secretary in the 60s, can stake a better claim as the father of modern China than Chairman Mao, and, if Beijing weren't so twitchy about these things, his would be the face they'd plaster all over the banners in Tiananmen Square. I point out the obvious because an Englishman never would. While some nations suffer from folie de grandeur, wrote President Bush's former speechwriter David Frum a year or two back, the British seem uniquely disposed to badmouth themselves. In the late 60s, Sir Richard Turnbull, High Commissioner of Aden, remarked bleakly to Defense Secretary Dennis Healey that the British Empire would be remembered for only two things: the popularization of association football, soccer, and the term fuck off. Instead of their bizarre cultural self-flagellation, the British might usefully deploy the latter formulation toward those kinky Euro-fetishists who think the future lies in liquidating English law, custom, and parliamentary democracy within the conglomeration of failed nation-states that make up the European Union. Britain was never an unrivaled colossus, even at its zenith. Yet today, in language, law, politics, business, and the wider culture, there is simply nothing comparable in scale or endurance to the Britannic inheritance. We now live in the American moment, and even if nobody's planning on leaving, the "what do you leave behind" question is worth asking. How does America want to use its moment? What does it wish to bequeath the world? Even to present the question in those terms feels vaguely un-American. The United States has an unmatched dominance that the British never enjoyed, and that is historically unprecedented. Yet it remains a paradox, the non-imperial superpower. For good or ill, the American people don't have an imperialist bone in their body, as we saw, in fact, in post-liberation Iraq. A week before the president's inaugural address in January 2005, I picked up the Village Voice for the first time in years. Couldn't resist the cover story, "The Eve of Destruction, George W. Bush's four-year plan to wreck the world." If only. It's so easy to raise expectations at the beginning of a new presidential term. In the wake of September 11th, the administration pledged itself to a long-overdue reversal of decades of misguided foreign policy that the second inaugural made explicit. Bush committed America to spreading freedom throughout the Muslim world. Or, as a skeptical friend of mine phrased it, we're going to shove liberty down their throats, whether they want it or not. It was presented as a kind of low-carb, organic, environmentally friendly version of the white man's burden. but no country has ever seemed more burdened by it. It's America's world. She just doesn't want to live in it. Almost as soon as American troops entered Iraq, Senate Democrats demanded to know what the exit strategy was. Exit strategy is a phrase that might have been designed as a textbook definition of lack of will. In war, there are usually only two exit strategies, victory or defeat. The latter is easier. Just say, whoa, we're the world's dominant power, but we can't handle an unprecedentedly low level of casualties, so if you don't mind, we'd just as soon get off at the next stop. Taking your ball and going home is a seductive argument in a paradoxical superpower whose inclinations on the right have a strong isolationist streak and on the left a strong transnational streak, which is isolationism with a sappy face and biennial black tie banquets in EU capitals. Transnationalism means poser solutions, the Kyotofication of foreign policy. For a serious power, the correct answer to what's the exit strategy is there isn't one, and there shouldn't be one, and it's a dumb expression. The more polite response came in the president's second inaugural speech. The survival of liberty in our land increasingly depends on the success of liberty in other lands. If you want an example of exit strategy thinking, look no further than the southern border. A century ago, American policy in Mexico was all exit and no strategy. That week's president for life gets out of hand, go in, whack him, exit, and let the locals figure out who gets to be the new bad guy. If the new guy gets out of hand, go back, whack him, and exit again. The result of that stunted policy is that 3/4 of Mexico's population is now living in California and Arizona, and, as fine upstanding members of the undocumented American community, they've got no exit strategy at all. Judging from the placards brandished at the Million Mexican Marches held across the United States in 2006, honkies, why don't you take your asses back to Europe? Many of them feel it's the documented Americans who ought to be planning on an exit. By contrast, the British went into India without an exit strategy, stayed for generations, and midwifed the world's most populous democracy and a key U.S. ally in the years ahead. Which looks like the smarter approach now? Those American conservatives, the Realpolitik crowd, who scorn nation-building, ought to reflect on what the Indian subcontinent would look like if the British had been similarly skeptical. Today, it might well be another Araby, a crazy quilt of authoritarian sultanates, Hindu and Muslim, punctuated by thug dictatorships following Ba'ath-type local variations on fascism and Marxism. It would be a profoundly unstable region with a swollen, uneducated citizenry of little use for call centers or tech support. Any American who's found himself at 3 a.m. talking to Suresh or Rajiv in customer service will appreciate the benefits of an Indian education. He can thank Lord Macaulay and his famous 1835 government memo on the subject for that. London dispatched generations of English, Scots, and Irish schoolma'ams and masters to obscure outposts of empire because they thought that by introducing them to Shakespeare and the Magna Carta and Sir Isaac Newton, they were effectively giving their colonial subjects a passport to the modern world. Failed states destabilize their neighbors, and Americans don't have to pore over maps of West Africa to figure that out. Insofar as 4 of the September 11th killers obtained the picture ID with which they boarded their flights that morning through the support network for undocumented workers, it's not unreasonable to argue that if you're looking for really deep root causes for what happened that day, you could easily start with America's failure to nation-build in Mexico. And the problem with exit strategy fetishization is that these days, everywhere's Mexico. Literally, in the sense that the September 11th killers were part of the undocumented American community, and more figuratively, in the sense that if you've got a few $100 and an ATM card, you can come to America and blow it up. Everyone lives next door now. The United States, almost in inverse proportion to its economic and military might, is culturally isolated. I know, you've read 1,000 articles about America's cultural imperialism. And that's fine if you mean you can fly around the world and eat at McDonald's, dress at the Gap, listen to Hilary Duff, and go see Charlie's Angels 3 or Dude, Where's My Car 7, pretty much anywhere on the planet. But so what? The Merry Widow was both a blockbuster sensation on Broadway and Hitler's favorite operetta. If I sent my profile in to the average computer dating agency, they'd fix me up with Saddam Hussein. He and I have the same favorite singer, Frank Sinatra, and favorite candy, Britain's Quality Street Toffees. It's not enough. You can easily like American pop culture without liking America. In London, the broadsheet newspapers that devote most space to U.S. cultural trends, The Guardian, The Independent, are the most vehemently anti-American. Then again, if you despise America's trash pop culture, it'll make you despise America even more. Thus, Jean-Pierre Chevènement, former French foreign minister, and his celebrated assertion that the United States is dedicated to the organized cretinization of our people. A claim that's a lot more persuasive if you've never had the misfortune to sit through a weekend of French TV. In 2002, there was a shootout in a French town hall by some left-wing eco-loon, and one of the country's presidential candidates, Alain Modlin, deplored it as an American-style byproduct. One Frenchman kills eight other Frenchmen, and somehow it's proof of America's malign cultural influence. You can sort of see what he's getting at. With very few exceptions, wherever you live in the world, the landscape of the imagination is America. In the movie in your mind, the car chase takes place on the Los Angeles freeway, the love scene in Central Park, the massive explosion at the World Trade Center. The world watches Hollywood's America in a kind of post-neutron-bombed way. You get the sex and drugs and rock and roll, the shootouts and fireballs, but the spirit of the country remains as foreign as ever. This is not a healthy phenomenon. On The Things That Matter, which, no disrespect, Hilary Duff doesn't, the gap between America and the rest of the world is wider than ever. If you define cultural dominance as cheeseburgers, America rules. But in the bigger cultural sense, it's a taste most of the world declines to pick up. Europe and America, said George W. Bush in Ireland in 2004, are linked by the ties of family, friendship, and common struggles and common values. If so, the president and many other Americans have an all-too-common struggle articulating what those common values are. In Prague in 2002, Mr. Bush told fellow NATO members, "We share common values, the common values of freedom, human rights, and democracy." Big deal. In a post-communist world, these are vague, unobjectionable generalities to everyone except the head hackers in the Sunni Triangle. The common values stuff is the transnational equivalent of have a nice day. It's when you try to flesh it out that it all gets more complicated. The United States spends 3.4% of GDP on defense. The other NATO members spend on average 1.9%. So if they do share common values, Europe's prepared to spend a lot less defending them. On a raft of other issues, from guns to religion, America is also the exception. In North American terms, it's Canadian ideas, from socialized health care to confiscatory taxation, that are now the norm in the other Western democracies, and, alas, in many of the emerging democracies. The raucousness of American pop culture, jazz, showgirls, hard-boiled cops, belies the hyperpower's geopolitical circumspection. And on the receiving end, The Americanization of global pop culture puts a greater premium on being un-American in every other respect. Almost all the supranational bodies, from the EU to the International Criminal Court, are, if not explicitly hostile to American values, at the very least antipathetic to them. In the face of this rejection of the broader American culture, the popularity of Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie isn't much consolation. Britain exported its language, law, and institutions around the world to the point where today there are dozens of countries whose political and legal cultures derive principally from London. On islands from the Caribbean to the South Pacific, you can find miniature Westminsters proudly displaying their maces and hansards. But if England is the mother of parliaments, America's a wealthy spinster with no urge to start dating. Of all the new nations that have come to independence since 1945, not one has adopted the American system of republican decentralized federalism, even though it's arguably the most successful ever invented. The United States has zero interest in empire, for obvious reasons. For one thing, it's already as big as an empire, and most countries that controlled that big a landmass would probably run it in imperial fashion. Instead, America took a federation designed for a baker's dozen of ethnically homogeneous East Coast colonies and successfully applied it across the continent and halfway over the Pacific. It's not strictly true that the sun never sets on the American Republic, but it's up an awful lot of the time. Beyond that, Americans are deeply suspicious of the notion that you can swan around the world giving freedom to people. They have to want it, like the first Americans did. As we say in New Hampshire, live free or die. If the Iraqis want a free society badly enough, they'll stick with it. If they don't, and they take the easy option of falling for some puffed-up strongman, that's their problem, not America's. While this might be philosophically admirable, the practical drawback is that power abhors a vacuum. If America won't export its values, self-reliance, decentralization, others will export theirs. In the 80s, Paul Kennedy warned the United States of imperial overstretch. But the danger right now is of imperial understretch, of a hyperpower reluctant to sell its indisputably successful inheritance to the rest of the world. After Mao's victory, America's anti-communists famously demanded to know, who lost China? Answer, nobody. China wasn't lost. Chiang Kai-shek had never won it in the first place. He was merely an early beneficiary of American foreign policy's faith in unreal realpolitik, the system embodied in the cynical line that so-and-so may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. In the case of Mubarak, the House of Saud, and many others, the obverse is more to the point. He may be our son of a bitch, but in the end, he's a son of a bitch. Even if it wasn't licensing anti-Americanism as a safety valve for what might otherwise be more locally directed grievances, the Cairo government would not be a meaningful friend. There's a huge difference between having a regime as an ally and having a nation as one. The difference being Egypt's Mohammed Atta and 15 Saudi citizens flying through the windows of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, which suggests considerable limitations to the theory that, as long as America gets along fine with President Mubarak and key Saudi princes, it doesn't matter if everyone else in Egypt and Saudi Arabia is shouting, "Death to the Great Satan." That, too, is a lesson in demography. So instead of waiting 10 years and demanding to know who lost Japan, who lost Russia, and Europe, oh, and who lost Britain, analysts might be better advised to ponder why a supposed moment of unprecedented unipolar dominance doesn't feel like it. Most Americans are familiar with their stereotype abroad, the ugly American, loud, brash, ignorant, arrogant. It is, in most respects, the inversion of reality. America may be the most modest and retiring hegemon in history. You're either with us or you're with the terrorists? Most of America's European allies checked the neither of the above box, and most Middle Eastern allies checked the both of the above box. Belgium isn't exactly with the terrorists, but it isn't with us in any meaningful sense. Saudi Arabia is with us, but also funding the terrorists in every corner of the world, and both countries get away with it. America has huge advantages. On the continent, the Euro consensus is shrinking both its economy and its population. America is managing to grow both. Why then project American power through transnational institutions disproportionately in thrall to European ideas? Especially when the one consistent feature of 21st century politics is the comprehensive failure of the over-Europeanized international order. UN staff facilitate Saddam's subversion of the oil for food program. The EU subsidizes the Palestinian Intifada. The International Atomic Energy Agency provides cover for Iran's nuclear ambitions. The UN summit on racism is a grotesque orgy of racism. As we've learned since September 11th, if there is a white man's burden in the early 21st century, it's not the burden of doing one's bit for the natives, but doing so under a hail of continual sniping from Chirac, Schroeder, the Belgian guy, Kofi, Oxfam, the BBC, and a gazillion others. There's something a little bizarre about a so-called unipolar world, in which it's the unipole that gets shafted every time. And as the various local demographic adjustments start to take effect, America is in danger of finding itself in the same lonely camp as Israel. Nudge things half a decade down the road. There'll be an informal Islamo veto over many areas of French and European policy. Russia and China have already determined that, whatever their own little local difficulties with Muslims, their long-term strategic interest lies in keeping the jihad as an American problem. The internal logic of the demographic shifts will be to make much of the world figure it makes sense to be on the side America's not. Al-Qaeda thinks it's got America pegged, an effete, fleshy sultan sprawled languorously on overstuffed cushions, lost in sensual distractions. The choice for the United States is between those who believe America can take the lead in shaping the times and those who think the most powerful nation in human history can simply climb in the suburban and go to the mall for its entire period of dominance. That's what the great Democratic Party, all-purpose, multilateral cure-all for United States foreign policy, boils down to. We need to hand power back to the UN, or the EU, or the Arab League, or the Deputy Fisheries Minister of the Turks and Caicos Islands. Or, as Thomas Friedman, the hilariously tortured foreign policy grandee of the New York Times, agonized, Mr. Bush needs to invite to Camp David the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, the heads of both NATO and the UN, and the leaders of Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Syria. There, he needs to eat crow, apologize for his mistakes, etc., etc. Why would it be in America's interest to inflate the prestige of Boy Assad and Mubarak? This lame-o multilateral outsourcing is the geopolitical equivalent of subcontracting your lawn care to undocumented immigrants. Here you are. We don't mind giving you the money. Just take care of it. We don't want to know the details. We want to go back to watching American Idol. Is foreign policy just another one of those jobs Americans won't do? Common values and universal values are not all that common and universal, and the willingness to defend those values is even rarer. They've been sustained over the long haul by a very small group of countries. In the years ahead, America has to take the American moment seriously, in part to ensure that the allies of tomorrow don't make the mistakes Western Europe did. That means, at the very minimum, something beyond cheeseburger imperialism. In the end, the world can do without American rap and American cheeseburgers. American ideas on individual liberty, federalism, capitalism, and freedom of speech would be far more helpful. In 2004, Goh Chok Tong, the Prime Minister of Singapore, and a man who talks a lot more sense than most continental prime ministers, visited Washington at the height of the Democrats' headless chicken quagmire frenzy. He put it in a nutshell. The key issue is no longer WMD or even the role of the UN. The central issue is America's credibility and will to prevail. The Prime Minister of Singapore apparently understands that more clearly than many Americans. Chapter 9. The Importance of Being Exceptional. Citizens versus Dependents. Were I a Kerry voter, though, I'd feel deep anger, not only at them returning Bush to power, but for allowing the outside world to lump us all into the same category of moronic Muppets. The self-righteous, gun-totin', military-lovin', sister-marryin', abortion-hatin', gay-loathin', foreigner-despisin', non-passport-ownin' rednecks, who believe God gave America the biggest dick in the world so it could urinate on the rest of us and make their land free and strong. Brian Reed, Daily Mirror, London, November 5, 2004. In the film Superman Returns to fight not for truth, justice, and the American way, but instead for truth, justice, and all that stuff. In the not-so-subtle elision from the American way to all that stuff, much peril lies. The American way is human and thus imperfect, but the European way leaves you well and truly stuffed, like a dead parrot after a trip to the taxidermist. In the end, hard wars are won on the hardest ground, at home. Whatever changes America makes in its foreign policy and transnational relationships, the home front is critical. You can't win a war of civilizational confidence with a population of nanny state junkies. Take Brian Reed's list of American deformities, gun-totin', sister-marryin', foreigner-despisin', etc. It goes without saying that that's why I supported Bush in 2004, but I'm not sure it entirely accounts for the other 62,039,073 urinating rednecks. Mr. Reed, though, does usefully enumerate the distinctions that separate the American Republic from the rest of the West, differences that will become even more important in the years ahead. 1. Self-righteous. Who exactly is being self-righteous here? If you want a public culture that reeks of indestructible faith in its own righteousness, try Europe, especially when they're talking about America. If you disagree with European conventional wisdom, you must be an idiot, or a Nazi. As Oliver James told The Guardian the day after the 2004 U.S. elections, "I was too depressed to even speak this morning. I thought of my late mother, who read Mein Kampf when it came out in the 1930s, sick, and thought, why doesn't anyone see where this is leading?" Mr. James is a clinical psychologist and appears to have a bad case of projection. With respect to Mein Kampf, it's Europe that has resurgent anti-Semitism, the French Intifada, explicitly racist parties, the British National Party, and neo-fascists who, if not yet their country's leaders, have gotten near enough to be in the presidential runoff, Jean-Marie Le Pen, or form part of the governing coalition, Austria. 2. Gun-totin'. Americans tote guns because they're assertive, self-reliant citizens, not docile subjects of a permanent governing class. At dinner in Paris a couple of years ago, I was asked about this American sickness with guns. "Americans have guns," I said, "because a lot of Americans like having guns." My host scoffed. "A lot of people here would like to have guns, too, but they don't." "Exactly," I said. 3. Military lovin'. What's not to love? Americans take pride in their military on absolute grounds, but if they were to go all comparative about it, they'd point out there's something contemptible about Europeans preening and posing as a great power when they can't even stop some nickel-and-dime Balkan genital servers piling up hundreds of thousands of corpses on their borders. 4. Sister Marion. Back to demography. You can't be a redneck in Germany, Spain, or Italy when the birth rates are 1.1 children per couple. There are no sisters to bunk up with. 5. Abortion hatin'. Is Brian Reed saying he loves it? Abortion is one manifestation of what John Paul II called the reduction of sexuality into an instrument for self-assertion. Mr. Reed might respond, "Yeah, that's what's so great about it." But whatever one's tastes in this area, as the Pope understood, sex as mere self-assertion is a dead end. If the progressives either abort or decline to conceive their progeny, the progeny of the redneck knuckle-draggers will be the only fellows around. 6. Gay-loathin'. More projection. It's Amsterdam, where the poor gay guys now have to watch what street they turn down. It's Paris, where the gay mayor was stabbed by a gay-loathin' Muslim. Homophobia-wise, America's fundamentalist Christians have nothing on Europe's fundamentalist Muslims. 7. Foreigner despisin' non-passport ownin'. The only despisin' of foreigners that's going on here seems to be by Europeans toward Americans. Recall Margaret Drabble's diatribe from the beginning of this book. We only skim the surface. My anti-Americanism has become almost uncontrollable. It has possessed me like a disease. It rises up in my throat like acid reflux, that fashionable American sickness. I now loathe the United States and what it has done to Iraq and the rest of the helpless world. I can hardly bear to see the faces of Bush and Rumsfeld, or to watch their posturing body language, or to hear their self-satisfied and incoherent platitudes, etc. When one examines Brian Reed's anatomy of redneck disfigurements, most of them are about the will to survive, as individuals and as a society. If one were to formulate it less disapprovingly, self-righteous, gun-totin', military-lovin', Sister Marion, abortion-hatin', gay-loathin', foreigner-despisin', non-passport-ownin' rednecks equals culturally confident, self-reliant, patriotic, procreative, religious, democratic, constitutional rednecks who believe in national sovereignty rather than ineffectual poser multilateralism. As for Mr. Reed's bit about the biggest dick in the world so it could urinate on the rest of us, if it bothers you that much, why not try urinating back? Ah, but in Europe, it seems even that simple act is in the process of being feminized. Stapingkeln, standing while urinating, is disapproved of in Germany to the point where toilets can now be fitted with voice alarms triggered when the seat is raised. Hey, stand peeing is not allowed here and will be punished with fines, so if you don't want any trouble, you best sit down, orders the toilet ghost in a voice that imitates former Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder. The notion of German government leaders commanding you in the privacy of your own home to urinate like a woman seems almost too poignant an image of the peculiarly European blend of state-enforced docility. In contrast to the swaggering Texan cowboy, it's the last stand of the EU corralled. Yet millions of these devices have been sold, and Klaus Schwerma has written a book on the phenomenon called Stapingkeln, Die letzte Bastion der Männlichkeit, or Standing Urinators, the Last Bastion of Masculinity. This hardly seems the time to open up yet more unbridgeable cultural divides between the old world and the new. The British TV historian Simon Schama defined the Bush-Kerry divide as godly America and worldly America, hailing the latter as pragmatic, practical, rational, and skeptical. which is, naturally, exactly the wrong way around. It's the Christian fundamentalists, holy rollers, born-again Bible belters, and Jesus freaks of godly America who are rational and skeptical, especially of Euro delusions. It's secular Europe that's living on faith. Uncowed by Islamists, undeferential to government, unshriveled in its birth rates, redneck America is a more reliable long-term bet. The pasteurization is prologue. Lest you think this is veering close to the jingoistic xenophobia deplored by America's East Coast media, let me do a bit of America bashing. The softening and feminization of the Western world isn't merely a matter of gun confiscation. I've never been one of those Americans who's just plain old anti-foreigner, mainly because I'm not an American, I'm a foreigner. And so I'm quite partial to foreigners, apart from myself. I blush to say it, but I like French food, I like French coffee, I like French women. To be honest, I'd rather see some interminable French movie where Isabelle Adjani or Isabelle Huppert, or pretty much any other Isabelle, sits naked on the end of the bed smoking a cigarette and discussing with her husband how each of their affairs are going, then watch Arnold Schwarzenegger in Terminator 12. Please don't throw the book away in disgust until after you've paid for it. I've never subscribed to that whole cheese-eating surrender monkey sneer promoted by my National Review colleague, Jonah Goldberg. As a neocon warmonger, I yield to no one in my contempt for the French, but that said, cheese-wise, I feel they have the edge. When I'm at the lunch counter in America and I order a cheeseburger and the waitress says, American, Swiss, or cheddar, I can't tell the difference. They all taste of nothing. The only difference is that the slice of alleged Swiss is full of holes, so you're getting less nothing for your buck. Then again, the holes also taste of nothing, and they're not fattening. But either way, cheese is not the battleground on which to demonstrate the superiority of the American way. In America, unpasteurized, unaged, raw cheese that would be standard in any continental fromagerie is banned. Americans, so zealous in defense of their liberties when it comes to guns, are happy to roll over for the nanny state when it comes to the cheese board. Personally, I want it all. Assault weapons and camembert, guns and butter, and all the other dairy products that U.S. big government federal regulation has destroyed the taste of. The French may be surrender monkeys on the battlefield, but they don't throw up their hands and flee in terror just because the brie's a bit ripe. It's the Americans who are the cheese-surrendering eating monkeys, who insist that the only way to deal with this sliver of Roquefort is to set up a rigorous, ongoing Hans Blix-type inspections regime. France, for all its faults, has genuinely federalized food, a distinctive cheese every 20 miles down the road. In America, meanwhile, the food nannies are lobbying to pass something called the National Uniformity for Food Act. There's way too much of that already. The federalization of food may seem peripheral to national security issues, and the taste of American milk, compared with its French or English or even Quebecois equivalents, may seem a small loss. But take almost any area of American life. What's the more common approach nowadays? The excessive government regulation exemplified by American cheese? Or the spirit of self-reliance embodied in the Second Amendment? On a whole raft of issues, from health care to education, the United States is trending in an alarmingly fromage-like direction. As they almost say in New Hampshire, live brie or die. Americans should understand that the softening of a state happens incrementally. You can reach the same point as the Europeans by routes other than gun confiscation. Could America wind up as just another enervated, present-tense Western nation? Well, it's halfway there. I've no wish to be partisan, not because attacking the Democrats is, as the media say, mean-spirited, but because the Democrats have chosen to make themselves all but irrelevant to the great questions of the age. You can understand why the Dems miss the 90s. There was nary a word about war. Okay, you'd get the odd million-man genocide in Rwanda, but you tended to hear about it afterward, usually as a late-breaking item in the Clinton-Tierney Apology Act. Instead, it was an era of micropolitics, a regulation here, an entitlement there, a bike path and a recycling program everywhere you looked. Venusian Americans assumed they'd entered an age of permanent post-Martian politics, and they resented September 11th as an intrusion on their minimalism. When you're at an event for the anti-war movement, you realize it's no such thing. It's an I-don't-want-to-have-to-hear-about-this-war movement. So they mock Bush, Cheney, Rummy, and company as the real terrorists, the ones determined to maintain America in a state of terror. Oddly enough, this was how the left chose to live during the Cold War, when the no-nukes crowd expected Armageddon any minute. If you believe in a two-party system, in the end, even the integrity of the dominant party isn't served by the self-marginalization of the only alternative. The Democratic Party needs to get back in the game. But to do that, they've got to get over the bike path micropolitics and back on the unlovely central throughway of geopolitical reality. My way or the highway. Conservatives, on the other hand, embrace big government at their peril. The silliest thing Dick Cheney ever said was a couple of weeks after September 11th. One of the things that's changed so much since September 11th is the extent to which people do trust the government, big shift, and value it, and have high expectations for what we can do. Really? I'd say September 11th vindicated perfectly a decentralized, federalist, conservative view of the state. What worked that day was municipal government, small government, core government, the firemen, the NYPD cops, rescue workers. What flopped, big time, as the vice president would say, was federal government, the FBI, CIA, INS, FAA, and all the other hotshot, money-no-object, fancy-pants acronyms. Under the system operating on that day, if one of the many Algerian terrorists living on welfare in Montreal attempted to cross the U.S. border at Derby Line, Vermont, and got refused entry by an alert official, he would be able to drive a few miles east, attempt to cross at Beecher Falls, Vermont, and they had no way of knowing that he'd been refused entry just half an hour earlier. No compatible computers. Yet, if that same Algerian terrorist went to order a book online, Amazon.com would know that he'd bought the A to Z of infidel slaying 2 years earlier, and their "We have some suggestions for you" box would be proffering a 30% discount on suicide bombing for dummies. Amazon is a more efficient data miner than U.S. immigration. Is it to do with their respective budgets? No. Amazon's system is very cheap, but it's in the nature of government to do things worse and slower. Here's another example of Dick Cheney's government, the one we trust and value and have high expectations for, from the morning of September 11th. FAA Command Center. Do we want to think about scrambling aircraft? FAA Headquarters. God, I don't know. FAA Command Center. That's a decision somebody's going to have to make, probably in the next 10 minutes. FAA Headquarters. You know, everybody just left the room. Most of what went wrong on September 11th, we knew about in the first days after. Generally, it falls into two categories. One, government agencies didn't enforce their own rules, as in the terrorists' laughably inadequate visa applications. Or, two, the agency's rules were out of date. 3 out of those 4 planes reached their targets because their crews, passengers, and ground staff all blindly followed the FAA's 1970s hijack procedures until it was too late, as the terrorists knew they would. The next time a terrorist gets through and pulls off an attack, it will be for the same reasons. There'll be a bunch of new post-September 11th regulations, and some bureaucrat somewhere will have neglected to follow them. Or some wily Islamist will have rendered them as obsolete as his predecessors made all those 30-year-old hijack rules. That's an abiding feature of government. 90% of its ever-proliferating agencies just aren't very good. And if you put your life in their hands, more fool you. But on the fourth plane, they didn't follow the 70s hijack rituals. On Flight 93, they used their cell phones, discovered that FAA regulations weren't going to save them, and then acted as free men, rising up against the terrorists and, at the cost of their own lives, preventing that flight carrying on to its target in Washington. On a morning when big government failed, the only good news came from private individuals. The first three planes were effectively an airborne European Union, where the rights of the citizens had been appropriated by the FAA's flying nanny state. Up there where the air is rarefied, all your liberties have been regulated away. There's no smoking. There's 100% gun control. You're obliged by law to do everything the cabin crew tell you. If the flight attendant's rude to you, tough. If you're rude back, you'll be arrested on landing. For 30 years, passengers surrendered more and more rights for the illusion of security, and as a result, thousands died. On the fourth plane, Todd Beamer and others reclaimed those rights and demonstrated that they could exercise them more efficiently than government. The cult of regulation failed, but the great American virtues of self-reliance and innovation saved the lives of thousands. "Let's roll," as Mr. Beamer told his fellow passengers. By contrast, on March 11, 2002, 6 months to the day after Mohammed Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi died flying their respective planes into World Trade Center Tower 1 and Tower 2, their flight school in Florida received a letter from the Immigration and Naturalization Service informing it that Mr. Atta and Mr. al-Shehhi's student visas had been approved. Even killing thousands of people wasn't enough to impede Mr. Atta's smooth progress through a lethargic bureaucracy. And the bureaucrats' defense, which boiled down to, "Don't worry, we're only issuing visas to famous dead terrorists, not obscure living ones," is one that Americans largely have to take on trust. A furious President Bush insisted that the INS take decisive action against those responsible, which it did, moving Janice Sposato sideways to the post of Assistant Deputy Executive Associate Commissioner for Immigration Services. I don't know what post she was moved sideways from. Possibly Associate Executive Deputy Assistant Commissioner. Happily, since then, the INS has changed its name to some other acronym and ordered up a whole new set of business cards. Extra large, if Ms. Sposato's title is anything to go by. Given the difficulty of reforming the torpid bureaucratic culture, the best we can hope for is to constrain its size and leave enough space so that a nimble and innovative citizenry don't degenerate into mere subjects of an overbearing state. In 2004, Wired magazine ran an interesting featurette about a fellow called Hans Monderman, a highway engineer in northern Holland for the previous three decades. A year or two back, he'd had an epiphany. As Wired's Tom McNichol puts it, "Build roads that seem dangerous, and they'll be safer." In other words, all the stuff on the streets, signs for everything every 5 yards, yellow lines, pedestrian crossings, stoplights, crash barriers, bike lanes. All that junk clogging up the highway by giving you the illusion of security, in fact, makes driving more dangerous. The town of Christianfield, in Denmark, embraced the Monderman philosophy, removed all the traffic signs and signals from its most dangerous intersection, and thereby cut the number of serious accidents down to zero. These days, when you tootle toward the junction, there's no instructions from the Department of Transportation to tell you what to do. You have to figure it out for yourself. So you approach it cautiously, and with an eye on what the other chaps in the vicinity are up to. Mr. Mondermann's thesis feels right to me, that by creating the illusion of security, you relieve the citizen of the need to make his own judgments. Howard Zinn, in his introduction to Cindy Sheehan's book, Dear President Bush, pens this peon to the plucky underdog. A box cutter can bring down a tower. A poem can build up a movement. A pamphlet can spark a revolution. But the only reason a box cutter can bring down a tower is because on September 11th, our defenses against such a threat were exclusively the province of the state. If 19 punks with box cutters had tried to pull some stunt in the parking lot of a sports bar, they'd have been beaten to a pulp. The airline cabin, however, is the most advanced model of the modern social democratic state, the sky-high version of the wildest dreams of big government. It's Massachusetts in cloud cuckoo land. So on September 11th, on those first three flights, the cabin crews followed all those Federal Aviation Administration guidelines from the 70s. By the time the fourth plane got into trouble, the passengers knew the government wasn't up there with them. And within 90 minutes of the first flight hitting the tower, the heroes of Flight 93 had figured out what was going on and came up with a way to stop it. That's been my basic rule of thumb since September 11th. Anything that shifts power from the individual judgment of free citizens to government is a bad thing, not just for the war on terror, but for the national character in a more general sense. Charles Clark, formerly Britain's Home Secretary, gave a revealing glimpse into the big government mentality in a column for The Times, defending the latest allegedly necessary security measure. ID cards will potentially make a difference to any area of everyday life where you already have to prove your identity, such as opening a bank account, going abroad on holiday, claiming a benefit, buying goods on credit, and renting a video. Renting a video? That sounds about right. When you go to Blockbuster, you'll need your national ID card. But if you're an Algerian terrorist cell coming in on the Eurostar from Paris to blow up Big Ben, you won't. And its requirement for the routine transactions of daily life, opening a bank account, buying goods on credit, will have the same impact as all those street signs and traffic lights at that Danish intersection. It will relieve bank managers and store clerks of the need to use their own judgment in assessing the situation. You'd have to have an awful lot of faith in government to think that's a good thing. Britain's religious hate crimes law is another example of excessive street signage applied to the byways of society. It attempts to supplant human judgment with government management. The multicultural state is working out so well that we can no longer be trusted to regulate our own interactions with our neighbors. Islam, unlike Anglicanism, is an explicitly political project. Sharia is a legal system, but unlike English common law or the Napoleonic Code, for the purposes of public debate, it will henceforth enjoy the special protection of Her Majesty's government. Given that the emerging Muslim lobby groups are already the McDonald's coffee plaintiff of ethno-cultural grievance mongers, you can be certain they'll make full use of any new law. Political debate in Europe is already hedged in by excessive squeamishness. Holland's immigration problem is a Muslim problem. France's youth problem is a Muslim problem. The terrorism threat that necessitates those British ID cards is in reality an Islamic threat. How is preventing honest discussion of the issue going to make citizens any safer? The term nanny state hardly covers a society where you need retinal scan ID in order to rent Mary Poppins, but you're liable for prosecution if you express your feelings too strongly after the next bombing. Cradle to grave. Restoring the balance between the state and the citizen is most urgent when it comes to reversing the biggest structural defect of the developed world. You'll recall that during the Iraq War, we heard a lot of talk about ancient Mesopotamia, the land of the Sumerians, Akkadians, and Hittites, being the cradle of civilization. That's a very pertinent formulation. Without a cradle, it's hard to sustain a civilization. Demography is not necessarily destiny. Today's high Muslim birth rates will fall, and probably fall dramatically, as the Catholic birth rates in Italy and Quebec have. But it's no consolation that Muslim birth rates will be as bad as yours in 2050, if yours are off the cliff right now. The last people around in any numbers will determine the kind of society we live in. And right now, the last people around Europe will be Muslims. For many nations, it's already too late. As Romania and other communist countries belatedly discovered, even a repressive dictatorship has a hard job coercing the populace into breeding once they've lost the habit. When I've mentioned the birth dearth in newspaper columns on abortion, pro-choice readers have insisted it's due to other factors, the generally declining fertility rates that affect all materially prosperous